Welcome to Let's Talk Social Work. My name is Andy McClenahan, and in this episode, my guests and I are looking ahead to the forthcoming general election. Exactly when that's going to be, we don't yet know. We'd planned this episode for April in case the government called an election before the summer. This seems unlikely to happen now, but what we do know is what needs to change to improve situations for social workers and the people who use social work services. And that's what we're going to discuss today. The asks outlined in the British Association of Social Workers 2024 General Election Manifesto. There are 40 asks in the manifesto, and we're not going to be able to cover them all today, but I've included a link in the show notes that accompany this episode so you can access the document and have a look at all 40. With me to discuss the manifesto are Kerry Prince, BASWA's Public and Political Affairs Lead, and Martin Sexton, outgoing Chair of BASWA's Policy, Ethics and Human Rights Committee. Welcome, Kerry. Welcome, Martin. So good to have you both back on the podcast. How are you doing? Kerry, how are you?
Yeah, good. Thanks, Andy. Thanks for inviting me back. It's been a while.
It was back in September, I think, we made an episode talking about age assessments of unaccompanied minors.
Important,
Yeah, I mentioned that because we're going to come on to that in the manifesto asks. Martin, it's been longer. December 2022, I could hardly believe when I was looking back, yes.
I know. No, I can't believe it either. We've checked the diary, and that's when it last was talking about human rights. So it's very very good to be back on the podcast again.
Thank you, Martin. And that was talking about the government's then plans to replace the Human Rights Act with a Bill of Rights, which I believe is that plan has maybe withered on the vine. Would that be correct to say?
Along with a few other things, yes.
Yeah, mercifully. Well, great. So nice to have you back. And I mentioned that Martin is the outgoing chair of BASWA's Policy, Ethics and Human Rights Committee. Martin, you are a gregarious, socially confident chap, but I don't mean, when I say outgoing, that's not what I mean. Your tenure is...
That's right. My second term of 2 years is coming to an end this summer. So it's going to be a... Not quite sure what I'm going to do with myself. I'm sure other people will have ideas on what I should be doing, but it's been a great privilege and pleasure to chair PHR, and even more of a pleasure to be able to hand over to Annie Ho, who will be the new chair, and I'm sure she will lead PHR to further heights. So looking forward to seeing how the committee works in future and giving it my full support.
Wonderful. And it's always been wonderful having you on the podcast. And I would hope that you would still be keen to come on in the future. Maybe you think, no, I've done my bit, but it'd be lovely.
please keep me on your list. Yes. Always good to do this.
Wonderful. Now, I mentioned in the introduction that there are 40 asks in the BASWA's UK 2024 general election manifesto. All are important, but I do know that there are five that BASWA is prioritising, and that these are what we're going to look at to begin with. Depending on how time goes, we might get to look at some of the other 35. But before we get into each, I'm going to list these five priority asks. Now, by the nature of the way the UK government works and the devolved nature for much of social work, not all the asks in the manifesto apply equally across the whole of the United Kingdom. Some do. Some apply only to England, Scotland and Wales. Some apply only to England and Wales. So we'll try to keep you up to date just as we go through what applies where. But first of all, scrap the two-child limit and benefit cap. That's a UK-wide ask. Secondly, repeal the 2023 Illegal Migration Act. Again, that's a UK-wide ask. Third, increase the non-taxable mileage allowance to 60p a mile. That's for England, Scotland and Wales. Fourth, the need for a new Mental Health Act. That is England and Wales. And fifth, the reform of social work student bursaries. That is England only. Now, I want to highlight our next episode, which is due out on Thursday, the 9th of May. That's going to explore anti-poverty issues ahead of the general election. And the guests are going to be Helen Bernard from the Trussell Trust and food poverty campaigner Dominic Waters. We'll also be joined by BASWA Chair Julia Ross. And during that, we'll be discussing the two-child limit. So we don't need to get into too much depth right now, but it would be good to get an overview of what that ask is. So the two-child limit and the benefit cap, what are they, Kerry, and who do they affect, and why do they need to be removed?
So the two-child cap has been widely talked about over the years when it was introduced. Essentially, it puts a limit on the number of children that you can claim benefits for. So you can claim benefits such as child tax credits and universal credit for up to two children, no more after that, except in exceptional circumstances, such as if a child was conceived outside of consensual sex. And the benefit cap is a cap on the amount of benefits that a household can receive. So what these have done is essentially make families, larger families, much worse off, because they then don't get enough income to support the family of their size. Now, some view this as necessary, because why should the taxpayer fund families who aren't working? But the truth is, most families are working. Wages are not enough to support families, and the state is subsidising because we've allowed low wages to go unchecked and unchallenged.
Yeah, and I'm aware that the majority of families that are in receipt, or sorry, that are affected by the two-child limit are working families. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a huge, huge amount. It's £3,455 per year per child that you lose out on if you're affected by the two-child limit. That's a, you know, it's a huge hit to a family's budget.
Yeah.
Do we know what the benefit cap sets benefits at? What's the limit there, the threshold?
The benefit cap varies based on your situation. If you're a couple who, or you have children, you live outside of London, it's £423.46 a week. But if you're in a couple or you have children and live in London, it's £486.98 a week. Now, if you're single and live outside London, you get the least, £283.71 a week. And if you're single and live in London, £326. So it does vary based on where you live and whether you have children or whether you're in a couple.
Thanks, Kerry. Just coming back to the two-child limit, I mean, it's really significant. I was reading some information published in December 2023 by the End Child Poverty Coalition, which Baswa, I believe, is a member of. The coalition highlighted that in 2021-22, across the UK, the poverty rate for children in families with three or more children was 42%. And that compares to 23 and 22% among children in families with one or two children, respectively. So children that are in larger families, much more likely to be in poverty. Two-child limit has a massive impact in terms of families' finances. I think that's the same, the Child Poverty Coalition, their research published just at the end of last year, found that, I think in England, 10.8% of children are affected by the two-child limit. In Wales, it's 11%, Scotland, 9%, Northern Ireland, 10%. So really, really significant reach. So tell me more, why has Basel then focused in on the two-child limit and benefit cap as one of its five priority areas for change?
We focused in on this. It's something we've been campaigning on for a while now. Baswa has a social work stands against poverty campaign, and it's also part of that. Limiting the amount of money that a family, often a very low income family, can receive will hurt the children more than anyone. It'll limit their life choices. Being a parent is hard. Being a parent in poverty is even harder, is something that Baswa says quite often. And we see how poverty can impact rates of social work intervention where children are concerned. So for us, it seems like a no-brainer. Families need more money to get by, to make life less difficult than it can be for people who are living in poverty. And increasing the amount that a family receives, even by a relatively small amount, can make a difference in life chances.
Thanks, Kerry. Now, Martin, as chair of Baswa's Policy, Ethics and Human Rights Committee, you oversee all of Baswa's policy output. But I want to just kind of relate this back to your practice. You work in adult services, I believe.
Yes,
how do you see poverty impacting the lives of the people that you work to support?
I think it's becoming increasingly significant. You know, my colleagues tell me that it's becoming more of an issue across the board with the people they're supporting. They're finding themselves asked to support younger people more often now, people who are having difficulties often with their mental health, possibly with substance abuse, but where poverty is clearly playing a part in this. You know, that their ability to kind of manage and stay afloat is being significantly impacting, and it's leading to other problems. So, you know, Kerry says that the main driver for opposing this policy is because of the harm it does to children, but it's harmful for adults as well. And you know, we've seen people, more and more people being drawn into poverty through, you know, the increasing cost of living recently. You know, this policy was enacted quite a long time ago. It, you know, circumstances have deteriorated significantly for a lot of people in this country. Many, and they're working people. You know, many people who are caught up in this, you know, many of these families have at least one person in work. So, for all sorts of reasons, it's something that the social work association for this country that we're opposed to, have been since its inception, will continue to be, and we're hoping that the general election, whenever it comes, will give an opportunity for this to be debated again, and for Basil's voice to be heard in support of the people who are affected by this.
And as I understand, in terms of the policies of the Conservative Party, it's obviously Conservative Party policy. Labour under Jeremy Corbyn had vowed to remove the two-child limit. Labour under Keir Starmer's leadership have rescinded on that. So in terms of how optimistic we are that there is going to be change after the general election, what are your views?
Well, I'll briefly comment on that, and then Kerry can fill in. Obviously, that's the stated position of the parties at the moment, and that's disappointing. But we, as we've said, you know, throughout this discussion, you know, it's something that Basil feels very strongly about for a range of different reasons, and we will continue to campaign on this issue after the election. Whoever wins the election, whatever their policy position turns out to be, to keep getting the point across that, you know, this is harming some of the most vulnerable members of our society, and it's something that, as social workers and with our commitment to social justice, that we're not going to just accept. And so we're going to keep campaigning along with our partners in the Child Poverty Coalition and other groups to keep this issue on the agenda.
Yeah, it's disappointing that political parties aren't rushing forward to say that this is the two-child limit and the benefit cap are obviously bad policies that hurt outcomes, especially for children. The hope is a new government will bring a refreshed energy to change these issues. And they might view that scrapping the two-child cap and the benefit cap are not the way to do this. So we will keep pushing on this. We'll see what the next government puts forward. And it may be that they put forward other solutions, but we will judge them when and if they come up.
Thanks, Kerry. And I'm going to move on before I get into even more depth on this, because we are going to be coming back to, as I said, listeners, in our next episode in a fortnight's time. But if we're staying with issues that apply across the whole of the UK, one of those is the Illegal Migration Act. And Baswa is campaigning to see the Illegal Migration Act repealed. You know, why is this such an issue for Baswa? Why does this matter so much, Martin?
Again, it comes back to our fundamental orientation as a profession committed to social justice and human rights. The legislation constitutes a very serious violation of the human right to seek asylum and to seek refuge from fleeing from persecution. It also the direct impact on practice, the increasing numbers of people who are being failed by our asylum system. This piece of legislation is a distraction from the failure of our system, and that failure impacts first and foremost on the individuals themselves, many of whom are children, and then secondarily on the social workers who are being called upon to try and support them, to try and help them, and to deal with the consequences of the terrible situations that people find themselves in, the impact on their mental health, the impact on family well-being. So for that direct reason, you know, it's an affront to our values, and secondly, it's having a significant impact on colleagues across the country. We remain implacably opposed to this piece of legislation, and we need, you know, its repeal needs to be part of a wider review of our commitment to asylum and supporting refugees. We have a system that isn't working. That hasn't worked for some considerable time. We are in a different world from when the Refugee Convention was enacted, but the challenges are still the same in lots of ways. And very often, the actual acceptance rates for people claiming asylum are very high. You know, people coming forward with genuine claims, genuine reasons to flee persecution and bring their skills and their talents to this country. And many areas, we need people with the skills and the talents that these individuals are bringing. So the current approach is wrong in it's wrong in principle, and it's wrong in practical terms as well. And the the Illegal Migration Act is just the most egregious example of this. So we're opposed to it. We've set out our position, encouraging our members not to take part in any of the mechanisms of the bill, and that will continue to be BASWA's position after the election.
Okay, thank you, Martin. Now that's helpful, but let's get into some detail. What does the Illegal Migration Act cover? Is this people will probably be most familiar in relation to the government's plan to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda. Isn't that correct? That's a core part of this act.
Yeah, it's deporting them to a safe third country.
Allegedly
safe. Which.
And, the Supreme Court has ruled that Rwanda. Are deemed that Rwanda's not a safe country and deemed therefore the plans unlawful. Isn't that correct, Kerry? Sorry to
run across you. Yes, and that's why the government have brought in a safety of Rwanda bill. So there is literal legislation, black and white, that says Rwanda is safe.
Forgive me for being, I'm not trying to be churlish, but how does a piece of legislation enacted in the United Kingdom make a third country safe?
Because that's the law now, Andy. They said something is law, and so that's the law. So that makes it more difficult for the courts to say, well, this is unlawful, because actually it's the law.
Okay.
As absurd as that is.
Yeah. So I'm not being slow-witted in finding this difficult to understand. It all seems slightly.
Oh yes, yeah. And you'd be forgiven for thinking that this was all just a big election tactic as well.
Okay. Is there other aspects other than plans to deport migrants to safe third countries, safe in inverted commas third countries? Is there other aspects that the Act covers?
So a big part of the legislation and why BASWA has responded the way it has to it is the changes it makes for unaccompanied asylum seeking children. So a child has various protections that adults don't have. Up until now, with the Illegal Migration Act, you're not able to deport a child. A child's entitled to protections and accommodation and care by the state. And what happens now under the Act, is that the Home Secretary has the powers to deport a person under 18. They can be deported once they are 18, and that poses a whole range of problems, such as how do we then prevent asylum-seeking children from disappearing shortly before their 18th birthday if they knew they were about to be deported. But it means the Home Secretary can also deport under 18s. And it also makes changes to age assessment of unaccompanied asylum-seeking children, which is primarily a social worker task through a Merton-compliant age assessment. But the government has introduced scientific methods of age assessment with this act. And
now, Kerry, can I just intervene? Because I think, is that not the Nationality and Borders Act that did that rather than the Legal Migration Act?
Yes. So the Legal Migration Act, while it does refer to the age assessments for unaccompanied asylum seeking children, yes, it was first mentioned in the Nationality and Borders Act. What the Illegal Migration Act does is it furthers that government's position by saying that if a young person does not consent to a scientific method of age assessment, they will be deemed to be an adult, essentially, and their claim will be would not be permissible. So it furthers the government's approach to scientific methods of age assessment, and it does then spell out x-rays and MRIs in statutory instruments following the bill. But it was the Nationality and Borders Act that originally introduced the idea of scientific methods.
Thanks, Kerry. That's really, really helpful. Thanks so much for clearing that up. BASWA has said in its manifesto that the Illegal Migration Act risks breaching UK and international law. What law specifically, Martin, and how does it breach them?
It's the Refugee Convention. Okay. Basically, it's the Illegal Migration Act creates this this notion of illegal entry, that you entering claiming asylum illegally. Without providing really any support for any legal way of claiming asylum, so it's a device to evade our obligations under the Refugee Convention by creating this category of illegal migration. Bearing in mind the claims, the successful claim rate is very high. you know, most of the people coming to this country do have genuinely well-founded reasons for claiming asylum. And it also seriously jeopardizes the safety of children, as Kerry's alluded to, this notion of scientific age assessment. There are no methods of scientifically assessing the age of a child. There are various measures you can take that will enable you to estimate someone's age, but the estimates are pretty broad and are nowhere near as specific and as sharp as you would need for a process of this kind. If you speak to the scientists, if you speak to the clinicians, the paediatricians, the radiographers, etc., they will tell you this can't be done. This can't be done. And so constructing this idea of scientific age assessment is another way of potentially another way of undermining our obligations under international law to refugees, which is one of the principal reasons why BASWA has strongly encouraged its members to not get involved with this process.
And yes, that was the episode that Kerry and I made back in September with Joe Schofield, Director of Immigration Social Work Services, that was specifically about the age assessment of unaccompanied asylum seeking children. So for, you know, a really in-depth look at that, I would encourage listeners to go back and dig into that episode. There's just one final point I wanted to just flag up before we moved on. Actually, a couple of points, sorry. There's been a lot of misinformation. There's this narrative, which is repeated frequently in the media, that people seeking asylum are legally bound by the 1951 Refugee Convention to seek asylum in the first safe country they come to. And that's just not the case. I'm correct in that, isn't that right?
I believe so, yes. I mean, the government's trying to introduce legislation to this effect, but I don't believe that's what the convention says.
Yeah, yeah. And it's bizarre or kind of scary just how a piece of misinformation can be amplified and repeated to the point that it becomes as if it is established knowledge. I didn't have any plans to talk about this. I've started to reread 1984. I haven't read it since I was about 21. I'm now 41. It's really interesting to kind of come back to that and look at it through the eyes of, shall we say, a grown-up. Yes, that concept of just repeating something until it is taken as sort of established truth when it's nonsense. Now, let's move on. This is another ask. This one, though, is getting a bit more specific. This is for England, Scotland and Wales only. Doesn't relate to Northern Ireland. But it's BASWA's call for an increase in the non-taxable mileage rate allowance to 60p a mile for social workers. Kerry, what is the non-taxable mileage rate currently at?
So I believe it's 45 pence at the moment.
Okay, so that... Okay, check my maths. That's a 33% increase, basically, to 60p. How was that 60p a mile figure arrived at?
Well, I think we're looking at what the NHS staff in England get and in Scotland get. In England, it's 59 pence, and in Scotland, it's 61 pence. So 60p would be parity.
Okay, okay. And is there any reason why BASWA hasn't stretched to going for the higher level of 61p?
Well, I think finding a medium between the two countries is appropriate. And I mean, I haven't heard a good argument why social workers should get more than NHS workers.
Okay, so if the rate is set at 60p a mile, would employers automatically have to pay that rate if the next government raised it to 60p a mile, or is there a discretion there?
No, so even if the non-taxable allowance was increased, it would still be down to local authorities to set their own rate. So we also need to be making the case for government to ensure that local authorities are well enough funded to enable them to raise it. Obviously, in Scotland, this is down to the Scottish government. So there are definitely two parts to this campaign. And it's not simply the case of getting local authorities or getting HMRC to make the changes. It's about both of them working together to recognise the issue.
And I'm guessing it's going to be an issue, more of an issue for some social workers. If you're working in the Highlands of Scotland, for example, in a sparsely populated area, driving much, much longer distances, the increase in the mileage rate is going to have a much better, bigger impact for you than if you are, I'm guessing, maybe somewhere where you are, Martin, you're based in Manchester, sort of...
Based in Salford and Greater Manchester, yes. Yeah. I think you're right, Andy. It's obviously, it's going to have a significantly greater impact on some social workers than others. But I think the key point here is there's an issue of equity here. that and demonstrating that the hard work that social workers are doing in their communities is valued the way that, in the same way that the hard work of NHS professionals is valued. You know, we want social workers to be spending as much time as possible with the people that they're supporting, you know, going out to them in the community where they are, you know, meeting them in the best possible locations for them, so to have the best conversations with them. So it's you know, it's the principle of it as well. It's encouraging and valuing that way of working, and saying that you know what a social worker is contributing is of the same value as an NHS professional, and you know it should be treated the same way.
Okay, now moving on again, we are looking at an England and Wales only ask. So we're getting more specific geographically, and this is ask number 18 in the manifesto, and it's for a new Mental Health Act. Now, I'm aware that the government published a mental health bill back in 2022, but it hasn't made any significant progress, and it certainly won't become law this side of the election. The manifesto highlights that much of existing mental health legislation is now over 40 years old and urgently needs updating. Martin, what's out of date and what does the new act need to cover?
Well, there's a whole range of different proposals in the draft bill, which was subject to extensive pre-legislative scrutiny and was developed by a very eminent and very talented and very diverse group of people to really look very hard at how to improve mental health legislation for our current society. One of the government's key objectives at the time was recognising was wanting to address the inequity in rates of detention amongst from people from different backgrounds. We know that people from black and global majority communities are more likely to be detained under the Act, more likely to receive compulsory treatment. Now there were question marks about how much of that you can achieve via legislation, but that was one of the aspirations at the time, which is obviously something that Baswell welcomes. And so it's unfortunate that point gotten lost along the way. Another specific about the Act was, well, the proposals were whether they were going to revise what's known as the nearest relative provision, which is if you are subject to detention under mental health legislation, then there is this role called the nearest relative of somebody who can support you, who needs to be informed about the process, and who can object on your behalf. Now, this is an ancient provision. It goes right back to the old, you know, asylums and 19th century, and it's not framed in terms of a fit for the modern world. It's something that needs to change from a human rights perspective, and something that the bill was making proposals on, and it's just, where is it? You know, it's just all disappeared into a siding somewhere. So at the very least, we would hope that the incoming government will review those recommendations as a matter of urgency and recognise the need for change, and then we can have a debate about what the specifics of those changes need to be. But at the moment, we have proposals that are just lying around somewhere and not being addressed by anybody, as far as we can see.
Do we know why it has been delayed so long?
I don't know. I reflect that, you know, we've been through several changes of prime minister in this current government, and at one point when Theresa May was prime minister, it seemed to be an area of greater personal concern to her, to make changes to mental health legislation and mental capacity legislation. And I think her predecessors, I think, perhaps have other priorities. But that's a personal reflection. I don't know that for a fact. What I do know is that at the moment, there doesn't seem to be the kind of capacity within the Department of Health that we'd need to see to bring this change forward. And I think that's an issue for the mental capacity legislation as well, which we'll come on to in a minute. And that's very frustrating. You know, obviously, myself, Kerry, and other members of Baswell, we have contact with government officials, and we can see that they understand the challenges that professions face, but they need political direction. They need ministerial directions in order to say, right, we're going to prioritise this now, we're going to move this forward. And it's not been forthcoming on the mental health bill or the mental capacity legislation. So that's frustrating for them, as well as frustrating for ourselves and other groups.
I agree with what Martin's saying. It's essentially not a priority for Rishi Sunak. In an election year, it isn't surprising that he would rather focus his government's attentions on legislation that may be of greater interest to the wider public rather than a technical bill that may go under the radar more than others, for example, safety of Rwanda bill.
I'm reading a statement here. This is from Baroness Buscombe. She was the former chair of the Joint Committee on the Draft Mental Health Bill. It notes in the statement, just to quote, "We've since witnessed the absence of the bill from the King's speech, compounding disappointment for those whose lives are bound up in some form with the Mental Health Act." Now, the King's speech, that sets out the government's legislative agenda. We hear in the news frequently about how little legislation is passing through the Commons and how much essentially spare time MPs have on their hands because there isn't much of a legislative agenda. So I just want to, hadn't planned to ask this, so forgive me if this question seems odd, but does government have capacity in its legislative agenda to actually pass the Act? Are they just choosing not to?
Sure. I mean, we've seen before that Parliament can push through legislation as quickly as it wants. Now, whether speed should be something applied to a Mental Health Act, I would say no. It needs to be carefully considered, properly thought out, lots of committee days to thrash out details of the legislation. It would take a lot of time. But the King's speech was it November? And we're in April now. I think it depends on whether we're going to have a general election in the first half of the year or the second. If we do see one in the first half of the year, they probably knew that it wouldn't have time to be properly scrutinised, passed. And it is a meaty bill with a lot of work that would need to go into it. Now, that's not an excuse because governments can carry on bills over to the next parliament. And Labour have said that they would bring in a revised Mental Health Act, I think they said in their first year. So there is political will. So they could have started it. But I mean, my view is that it simply wasn't a political priority for the Prime Minister.
Okay, and just came to me there, Kerry, when is, not that you know exactly, but when is your prediction for when the general election is going to be? I said at the introduction we're making this episode quite early in anticipation of, had the government called an election in May or June, we would have had mm-hmm. this episode out. Doesn't look like it's going to be before the summer, would that be right?
I think it's really hard to tell because I think Rishi doesn't know himself. If the Conservatives do well in May in the local elections, he may be tempted to go for it, maybe think the polls aren't as bad as they seem. If the safety of Rwanda bill struggled to get through, he might have called the election on the basis of, help me get this legislation through, even though it would have been the Lords that stopped it. So I think it just depends on what happens. I'm not sure Rishi Sunak knows. And there would be people around him who will be telling him what they think as well. So it's not as, I suppose, I don't think the Prime Minister even knows. I would probably put some money down on July if I was a betting person.
So I saw just a clip on Twitter. It was from a BBC political affairs programme, and it was Nicholas Watt from Newsnight was being interviewed. And the clip I saw was just talking about the government potentially having the election on the 11th of July. Now, anyone listening to this on my side of the Irish Sea, and many people I think on the eastern side of the Irish Sea will understand why that is a really bad idea from a Northern Ireland perspective. Nicholas Watt, I think, was being asked about this because he had spent time in Northern Ireland as a journalist. And then the suggestion that the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland would need to be saying to the Prime Minister the 11th of July for an election. Political sensitivities in Northern Ireland. Also the fact that the votes may not be counted in Northern Ireland. They might be delayed on account of that. Not that we're looking at anything like a hung parliament, you know, but when we had the situation before. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, when the DUP's votes basically supplied the confidence supply deal to prop up Theresa May's government, you could have a situation were that to happen again. You could be waiting a bit of time to get the votes in Northern Ireland counted.
Sorry, Andy, there's also the argument that you don't want it too close to November because of the US presidential election. Who knows what result that's going to throw up in two big Western powers having major government changes in the second half of this year. It's not ideal either.
Winter elections seem altogether wrong to me as well. The election which delivered Boris Johnson's big majority, that was December, wasn't that?
Yeah.
It was in the winter, yeah.
Yeah.
So bad for two reasons. Sorry, well, maybe for 80 reasons, I think. Sorry.
It's miserable, as you know, it's miserable campaigning in the winter, and it suppresses votes, and it suppresses certain types of votes. So there is a political reason to hold it in winter.
So thank you. Sorry, before I get any more waffling down any more rabbit holes, I just want to stay with this theme of mental health. And the manifesto flags the need to address the uncertainty of deprivation of liberty safeguards. This is in the context of the government's announcement in 2023 that it would delay the introduction of liberty protection safeguards. Martin, starting from the position that not everybody listening will be familiar with the concepts of deprivation of liberty safeguards and liberty protection safeguards, could you briefly explain what the current situation is and what needs to change?
Thanks, Andy. Yes. So we have a scheme in England and Wales at the moment called deprivation of liberty safeguards. It's designed to protect people who are unable to make their own decisions about their own care because of a reason like dementia or profound learning disability or serious brain injury or something like that, and whose care involves them being restricted in certain ways so that they're not allowed to, you know, wander out into the street and put themselves at risk and behave in ways like that because they would come to harm. So the restrictions are there to prevent them from coming to harm. Obviously, this is something that's a situation that's open to misuse and abuse. And we've seen that in various stories down the years, Winterbourne View and places like that. So there has to be a scheme of legal safeguards in place to protect people in these situations. What we've got at the moment is a scheme that was introduced in, it came into force in 2009. It's now being applied to many, many more people who were envisaged at that time who would need these safeguards. It's been recognized for a long time that it's not really fit for purpose, that it needs to change, that it needs to be better able to be accessible to all the people who might need this kind of safeguard, which, as you said, is many more than we thought when the scheme first came in. The government proposed a new scheme called Liberty Protection Safeguards, and like the Mental Health Bill, lots of work was done on it, and consultation took place, and a lot of development work was done. And then the government decided, well, we're just going to stop. You know, we're not going to do this side of the election. No clear reason given why. You know, there's a suggestion that there are resource issues and resource concerns, but I've never seen a really clear analysis of what they are, and therefore, you know, what are the challenges that we need to address if we need to bring this scheme in. So what we've got, we've got the existing scheme, which, you know, there are significant issues with that. There are lots of delays, lots of people waiting for these assessments. Quite a lot of people die before they actually meet an assessor. So you've got a situation where people's right to have their care properly scrutinised, and their right to object to what's happening if they're unhappy, and that right is recognised, and there's a process, and that they can raise their objections. It's not happening, and we don't have a clear framework for what might happen next, or, you know, if not this scheme, then what should we do? What are the challenges? What are the problems with it? Can we try and fix them? We just haven't been able to have that conversation at all. And caught up in this is the Code of Practice for the Mental Capacity Act, which is an absolutely crucial piece of legislation protecting potentially the rights of everybody in this country. Everybody in this country pretty much will rely on the protections of the Mental Capacity Act at some point in their lives. It's a much bigger issue than deprivation of liberty. The Code of Practice for that act is nearly 20 years old. It's out of date. It doesn't incorporate all the case law. It badly needs to be revised. As part of the Liberty Protection Safeguards process, you know, a draft code has been put together, which is a significant improvement, significant advance on what was there before. But because of these issues around the Liberty Protection Safeguards part of it, the whole thing's being delayed. So we've got this draft Code of Practice that's needed up and down the country by health and care professionals, by financial institutions, by the police, by everybody who might potentially have problems making decisions or who might come into contact and be needing to support someone who's having difficulty making decisions. And that's potentially everyone. And that's potentially every person in England and Wales. So it's a really significant piece of legislation, and it's a really significant issue that we don't have any clarity on when this new code will come into force.
And just in terms of the change, though, liberty protection, it's much more positive language than deprivation of liberty. What would, if you could sum up very briefly, what would in effect change with that new scheme compared to what we currently have?
What would change would be the processes for enabling you to have. To get the protection of the scheme to you would be streamlined, there would be more people who would be able to carry out the assessments. It would be more a part of the health and social care that you're receiving anyway. The DOL scheme that we currently have operates in sort of isolation. So there's a kind of degree of duplication, which is one of the reasons why there are waiting lists. So you'd have more people involved. It would apply in more settings. And also, it would be easier to challenge. You could challenge at a much earlier stage of the process, so that if you weren't happy with somewhere where there were going to be restrictions in your care, or your family weren't happy, then there would be you'd be able to challenge that much much quicker and more readily. So, from a sort of human rights perspective, it is an improvement. It's not perfect. But it is an improvement over the existing scheme in a number of ways. And so it's concerning that we don't have any clear direction on when it might come in or when elements of it might be brought in.
Here's one for you, Martin. When it does come in, God willing, you'll come back on and we can talk about it in more detail. Is that okay?
Yeah, I will. Yeah, when it does, or whatever's okay. Salvaged from it, whatever, wherever we go with this next. Yes, I'd be happy to come in and talk about it again.
Good. Thank you. I'll hold you to it. Appreciate it a lot. Now, the last of the five priority asks, this is for reform of social work student bursaries. And this is an England only ask. Responsibility for social work bursaries is a devolved matter. And BASWA and the Social Workers Union have been campaigning to see bursaries uplifted in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. Now, in relation to the situation in England, the manifesto states that bursaries for social work students in England are in desperate need of reform, and there's a capped number available. It also explains that there's been no increase in the number of bursaries since 2023, and funding has been frozen for more than 8 years. So that's a really significant situation. We know with the cost of living increase crisis just how difficult situations are for people in work. We know it's difficult for students as well. Tell me more, Kerry Martin, about what we're looking for in relation to the bursaries review.
Well, in England, every year, about 2,500 undergraduates are awarded a bursary of just over £5,000 in London, and it will be less outside of London, per year for their second and third years of study. And for postgrads, they get a bursary worth just over £3,000 if they're in London unless if they're outside of London, and that are kept at 1,500 a year. But the availability of the bursaries does not match to how many students we need to enrol on social work courses, and we see students drop out every year.
Okay, and we need more social workers at the moment. The argument, I suppose, is that if we're going to encourage more social workers to train, any more prospective social workers to train, they need to be supported financially. It's very, very difficult to commit 3 years to go to university if you're going to have a shortfall in terms of your ability to pay. Tell me more about the need for recruitment, Martin.
Yeah, we have a shortage of social workers. We're running at a nationally about a 10% vacancy rate. We know that the average length of time that social workers remain in the profession is around about 8 years, I believe. So we need to continually refresh the numbers of people who are coming forward into social work. I mean, obviously there are issues. There's a separate issue about retention, which feeds into the concerns that BAS has got about social workers' paying conditions, which is a separate campaign issue. But the figures show that we we need to keep focused on attracting people into social work. We need to keep, we need more social workers than we currently have. And recruitment and into university courses is where that starts. And it's another kind of inequity that some people get supported through their course and other people don't. I'm sure that the people who graduate with and without bursaries they're just as good social workers as they come out of the course at the end of it. So I think they should be treated the same way at the beginning of the course as well.
Thank you. Now, Martin, that is number 34 of our 40 asks, and I think that's where we're going to have to call it time.
Before we go, can I just say one more thing? Promote the vote.
Of course, promote the vote. Forgive me.
Yeah, so Promote the Vote is a national campaign. It's a reminder to everybody that there's no mental capacity threshold for voting, that everyone who wants to vote is entitled to vote. So it's a reminder to all of us who are working with people or who know people in our families who might need a bit of extra help to make it to the polling station or to apply for a postal vote. Don't assume that somebody's not interested in voting just because they're unwell or because they've got a mental health problem or a cognitive impairment or anything. Everyone's entitled to vote. So if you know people or you're working with people who are interested in voting, then please do find ways of helping them cast their vote and have their voice heard.
And if anybody wants to know more about Promote the Vote, we have, of course, been entirely comprehensive in our output. We made an episode in December 2023 about Promote the Vote. It was really, really good discussion. We looked at all aspects of the scheme and how social workers can support people who may have a learning disability to get involved in exercising their democratic rights. So please listen to that. Martin, Kerry, thanks so much for coming on to Let's Talk Social Work.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Andy.